From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Berkeley.
Berkeley, California.
Right north of the LeConte Street.
Coming up, a reporter goes undercover as a prison guard and learns what to do when two inmates are stabbing each other.
We should verbally tell them to stop, but we do not intervene. He said, if these fools want to cut each other up, then happy cutting.
Then we'll hear how inmates are reaching out to support one another inside San Quentin State Prison.
There are people who threaten to commit suicide, who do show signs and symptoms of being depressed and possible suicidality.
And we'll hear how one local performer uses song to connect people and preserve identity.
When we are connected within a group, that we are responsible to hold each other's stories for those times when we forget.
Connections inside and out, today on Cross Currents. Shane Bauer. If that name sounds familiar, that's because he's one of the Americans jailed in Iran back in 2009 while on a hiking trip. Bauer is a journalist, and he spent 410 days in Iranian jail on charges of illegal entry and espionage. His now wife, Sarah Shord, and friend Joshua Fatal were also imprisoned. Bauer was released in 2011 and has since written a book about his story. He's also been reporting on the American prison system, and for his latest report, he spent 4 months undercover as a prison guard at the Wynn Correctional Center, a private prison in Louisiana. He lived day in and day out witnessing prison life firsthand. What he experienced is detailed in a report he wrote for the San Francisco-based news magazine Mother Jones called My 4 Months as a Private Prison Guard. Shane Bauer came by our studios and I asked him first, how did he get a job as a prison guard?
I just didn't think it would happen. I mean, I just thought, well, I'll just try it. You know, it only takes an hour to fill an application. I didn't think it was going to go anywhere.
And then, really?
Yeah. And then once I start getting calls back, I was like, whoa, they want to talk to me. And I did some interviews and I never got asked why I wanted to work in a prison. I never got asked about my job history. I just was asked kind of boilerplate questions like, you know, if you are told to work with somebody who you don't get along with, how will you deal with it? You know, the kind of stuff that you might expect from like a McDonald's interview or something like that.
What was it like when you first went there? What was your impression about the place?
I mean, the first time I went in there was really nerve-wracking. I was like really high-strung. There were a few other people there. There was one guy that was right out of high school who asked me if I was nervous, and I said, yeah, I'm a little nervous, and I asked if he was nervous, and he said something like, not really, I've been around killing, my uncle's in prison, and, you know, he had been stabbed, and, I mean, he had a pretty rough life.
And out of high school, they're hiring him?
Yeah, there was a good number of people working there that were, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old.
What about the demographics? Were you, like, the only white guy?
Among the guards?
Yes.
In my group of cadets, actually, the majority were white. But in the prison in general, the guards were majority black and majority women.
Majority women?
Yeah.
In a men's prison?
Yeah. A lot of the doctors that worked at Wynn had histories of medical malpractice. And I don't know, you know, exactly how they ended up at Wynn. But that was kind of true in the different groups of employees. There was a set of people that had some kind of checkered history, and CCA hired them. There was a guard who had worked in a juvenile detention center who shattered the jaw of a 16-year-old kid by uppercutting him,
and
CCA hired him.
That's
I mean,
crazy.
He's making $9 an hour, but he has a job.
Mm-hmm.
There was a instructor teaching us about the use of force and asked what we should do if we saw two inmates stabbing each other. And
what should you do?
He said that we should verbally tell them to stop and call for backup on the radio, but we do not intervene. He said, if these fools want to cut each other up, then happy cutting. And, you know, the other part of it was that we, as guards, didn't have weapons. You know, we just had a radio. We didn't have mace. We didn't have a billy club. Nothing. So
is that normal? Is that
I mean, guards in a lot of prisons would have at least pepper spray. There was a tactical team called the SWAT team that they had pepper spray. So there was maybe five or so guys.
What is SWAT?
Staff. It means Special Operations Response Team. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a SWAT team kind of thing, but they use non-lethal weapons. And they're the ones that, you know, if there's a riot or something, would be sent in to to kind of try to bring it under control. A man had escaped right when I started training, and there was a lot of violence. There were a lot of stabbings happening. There was, I remember, in 2 days, there were 70 shanks found in the prison. And the lockdown went on for 11 days, and the prisoners were getting really frustrated about it.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba, and my guest is Shane Bauer from Mother Jones. We're talking about his article, My 4 Months as a Private Prison Guard. Was there a particular interaction with a prisoner or prisoners that you had that, you know, that just stands out to you and is memorable for you?
There are several of different kinds. I mean, there was one prisoner that I got to know who I call Corner Store in the story, who is somebody who basically run, you know, exchange items between different prisoners, like, you know, ramen packets for honey buns or something like that. And they would give him kickbacks. And I would, you know, spend a lot of time talking to him about the place and about other places he'd been and how they compared. And, you know, he'd been in prison for almost 20 years.
Well, we have a clip by Corner Store, and let's take a listen.
As far as fighting and stabbings, it doesn't surprise you anymore after you've seen it so long. Wind has no control, and they have no control over security whatsoever.
He was supposed to be released while I was working at Wynn, and I had this idea that he would get released and then I would find him while I was still working there, but then kind of find him and tell him I was a journalist and try to kind of follow him as he was reintegrating. And his release day came and went, and he was not released. He was, you know, essentially going to be released because he had enough good time that he would have been released early, but he didn't have an address to go to, and he wasn't fine. He wasn't being placed anywhere else, and he said that the person in charge at Wynn was just not really finding somewhere for him to go. So he ended up spending another year in prison, and when he did get out, I went to Louisiana and met him in Baton Rouge.
As a journalist.
Yeah. And he
what
knew.
What did he think?
Well, he said he insisted that he knew something was up, and he said he always saw me writing in my notebook, and it was there was something off about me. And other prisoners, while I was working there, would say, you know, there's something going on. There's something different about you. I was shocked to meet a man who lost his fingers and legs to gangrene because he wasn't getting medical treatment, even though he had been requesting it for months. The guards weren't something I was really thinking about going in. I was kind of more interested in the conditions for prisoners, but I found that the line between the two is very thin. I mean, there's basically the same socioeconomic class. A lot of guards are selling drugs in the prison themselves. Some of them knew prisoners from childhood. You know, they all kind of felt in some way exploited by the whole situation.
Hmm. Okay, I have to ask you this.
Uh-huh.
You once were a prisoner.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
In Iran. When going into Wynn, what did you feel in terms of that? And did you have any compare, contrast in your mind in terms of this? You know, this is the United States. We like to pride ourselves on being, you know, kind of the place where there is law and order, and that is Iran. And what kind of thoughts did you have?
Well, I didn't have any illusions about the U.S. prison system. I mean, you know, I'd been reporting on it for a while, and you know, I did a story about people that have been in solitary confinement for decades. You know, we have more prisoners here than anywhere by far.
Did your mind go back to Iran?
But I mean, it did maybe add another level to the kind of, I don't know, sense of shame sometimes at being a guard and the things that I had to do that job, you know, and to maintain. There were a lot of times I wanted to tell prisoners that I had been a prisoner myself, or tell them, you know, why I was there or something like that. But there were times that it came up, you know, that I thought of it. There was one time that I was handing out food trays, and somebody took an extra tray, and I just kind of started yelling at this guy. And there was a time when I was in prison that one of the more intense times of that experience, that my friend Josh took an extra food tray from a cart, and a guard flipped out on us. And, you know, there was a moment at Wynn where I was like, wow, here I am. It didn't take much for me to be on the other side of this, you know.
That's Shane Bauer, reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. His latest report is My 4 Months as a Private Prison Guard. Find a link to it at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Here at KALW, we also bring you stories reported from inside prison, stories not done by outside investigative journalists, but rather the inmates themselves. This is the San Quentin Prison Report.
The San Quentin Prison Report.
Bringing you hidden stories from life inside.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell, you see what goes on.
Because I like to be free. I like to move about the land.
You could hear a pin drop.
In prison, deaths by suicide create shockwaves. Inmates need help with handling the trauma. And that's where Brothers Keepers comes in. It's a suicide prevention and crisis support group that started in 2005, co-founded by an inmate named Dennis Pratt. Reporter Lewis A. Scott has the story.
Dennis Pratt was sentenced to 15 years to life for second-degree murder, and he's been in prison for 34 years. He'll never forget the morning a friend killed himself without warning.
We didn't see no signs of suicide or anything like that, and just all of a sudden he went to breakfast one morning, came back and hung himself with a sheet in his cell. And it caught a bunch of us off guard. It was such a shock to the yard that a bunch of us got together and we said, we got to do something about this. We got to be able to spot individuals who are in a crisis state, who are maybe thinking about committing suicide.
Pratt and his friends started Brothers Keepers, a support group for inmates to talk about their problems and their struggles with suicide.
All right, let's settle down. Let's get ready. Brothers Keepers are going to fix it and get started here. Jimmy, glad to have you here today.
Thank you very much, Dennis.
Glad that everybody made it today. Mac, glad to have you here. We're going to be talking a bit about suicide prevention and crisis intervention.
Brothers Keepers meet once a week. Pratt and other group leaders meet with inmates one-on-one to help them process the trauma they have experienced prior to coming to prison. Jimmy, who is a member of Brothers Keepers, will share his personal experience with suicide before coming to prison.
That night, as I laid in bed next to my wife, I started to attempt to slice my wrists. For some reason, God must have woke her up that night, because because she rolled over and she said, "What are you doing, honey?" And I said, "I'm going to kill myself."
They also meet in groups to help individuals process trauma that they have experienced while inside prison. Recently, an inmate died when he fell to his death from the fifth tier in West Block. Three inmates that meet with Brothers Keepers members share their versions of what happened, but they choose to remain anonymous.
I'm one of the first ones back while they're still releasing the tears. That's when I seen the shadow of him falling down, and we heard a slap, a loud slap, bang on the floor. And that's when I started seeing the blood come out of him.
To learn that he had actually, as it was portrayed to me, taken his own life, I frankly couldn't believe it.
The inmates who run Brothers Keepers aren't just good listeners. They are state-certified crisis counselors, thanks to training from BayWAR, Bay Area Women Against Rape.
BayWAR came and became involved and started teaching us how to spot people who are in crisis situations or who may be depressed.
Marcia Blackstock is the executive director of BayWAR in Oakland, California.
I actually started working in prisons in 1988 in Solana with the Victim Offender Reconciliation Group and did on and off work with people in San Quentin. And then in 2005, we were asked to come in and help start a crisis intervention training for some men who are requesting that because of a suicide that happened here in the community.
Sexual assault can cause serious trauma, so part of the inmates' training focuses upon that.
We are also fortunate enough to be able to train them as California State Certified Rape Crisis Counselors so they can get the dual certification or just go for the crisis intervention. So that's really wonderful because then they're certified right here to be able to work with anybody who's been sexually assaulted.
Pratt says that some inmates prefer talking to Brothers Keepers rather than prison officials because what they tell the state can affect their cases.
They are more open to listening to us because they know that we're not writing anything down and it's not going in their file or anything like that. We explore options with them. We help them come up with ideas, and which empowers them.
Pratt says that there's no discrimination when it comes to the people that the Brothers Keepers members counsel. They assist anyone and everyone.
And we don't ask people what they're in for because that doesn't make a difference to us, okay? I could be talking to a sex offender and not even know it because it doesn't matter. Our main concern is what are you going through? What do you need? Somebody may have had a family member who passed away, or get a denial at the parole board.
I asked Pratt what it takes to become a member of Brothers Keepers.
Making the commitment to be in the group every week. Maintaining confidentiality. After the training, then you have a 2-year commitment for practicing Brothers Keepers on the yard.
Pratt explains how they spot the inmates who need their help the most.
There are people who threaten to commit suicide, who do show signs and symptoms of being depressed and possible suicidality. And it's those individuals that we can look at and see and talk to and help them to see that there are people out there who care for them, that there are reasons to live, that there's nothing so terrible that we have to take our own life for.
I'm Lewis A. Scott with the San Quentin Prison Report.
That piece was produced by San Quentin Prison Report's Lewis A. Scott and originally aired in January 2015. The report is a project between KALW, The Prison Reporters, and Nigel Poor. For more information, go to our website, kalw.org, click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Oakland singer and vocal activist Melanie DeMore believes in the power of song to connect and lift up communities. It's what drives her work as a performer, songwriter, and teacher. Blessed with what she herself has called a very, very, very low voice, she's made a name for herself through music that blends African-American folk music with other American forms like spirituals and soul.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
That's Melanie singing at the Trinity Church in New York back in 2011. She trains people on how to find their own singing voices as a tool for preserving culture and community. Melanie DeMore spoke with KLW's Jen Chien.
Can you explain to me what you mean when you say vocal activist?
Well, one of the things that is part of my work is that I create spontaneous choirs with people. And that is to help activate people's inner voice, because we're kind of living in a time where there are a lot of people who don't have a voice. And it's really...
And you mean that literally as well as
literally,
figuratively.
So figured.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. And I think that people are hungry, really, really hungry, to do things together. And being able to create spaces where folks can come together and sing, you bring whatever it is into the room, and you just throw your head back and sing, and we do it together. And it's a way of being able to hold each other up.
And you have a very varied background. Mm-hmm. You grew up partly in Alaska. Mm-hmm. You were born in New York City. Your yeah. parents formed the first black theater company in Alaska.
One of the first black theater companies back in the day. Yeah.
You've lived in Texas and New yeah. Mexico. Mm-hmm. And before you became a vocal artist, I found out that you were in a convent. You drove a forklift. You were yeah. an actor. You were a chef.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of different stuff. So yeah. tell me about how you found your way into singing and into the life that you're in now.
Well, I've always been singing. Both my mother and father, brilliant vocalists. My mom was one of the first African-American women actually offered a scholarship to Juilliard way back in the day. But I'm very much like my mother. She didn't want to be confined by a conservatory, so she just wanted to sing. I always knew from the time I was about 4 or 5 that music was going to be my path. I knew it. My mom knew it, too.
So you're a founding member of the Bay Area favorites, Linda Tillery and the Cultural Heritage Choir.
Right. I'm not with the band anymore, but I was with them for 18 years, and I was a founding member of that band. And let me tell you, Linda Tillery, one of San Francisco's treasures and really one of the best vocalists in the country. And to be able to sing with her was it was a trip. We had so many wonderful adventures, and it was just amazing. And to do African-American roots folk music. And when we started the band, we were, you know, 5 African-American women, percussion-driven ensemble who threw down. Baby, we could throw down on some serious rhythm and drums and stick pounding. And, you know, yeah, it was an amazing experience.
And so how do you think that has influenced the music that you make now?
Oh, good Lord. Are you kidding? Changed my life. It was an extraordinary experience because we were doing the music that is the roots of all American music. Music of the Gullah South Sea Islands, slave songs, all of the music that is really the seeds of everything that we know as American music.
So probably some listeners have not heard of Gullah Stick Pounding. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what that is?
There's a whole series of islands around Georgia and South Carolina and Florida called the Gullah Sea Islands. And these particular islands, a lot of people have no idea that they're there, first of all. But the Gullah people have their own language. And most of the folks that ended up on these little islands out there, they were taken from around the area of Sierra Leone. And a lot of folks think that they
did. And you mean to become slaves?
Yeah, they were taken and became enslaved. But they were taken from Sierra Leone. Cash crops on the sea islands was rice. The folks in Sierra Leone knew how to grow rice. So these things are very specific. People think that it was known, that there was a plan as to where people were taken from. But one of the things that's so extraordinary about the Gullah people, and it's so extraordinary about human beings, is that you have these people that come with many, many different languages, and you got to figure out a way to make community out of no way. Created a language, a way to be able to express and to hold on to your own true identity in a situation that looks at you like you're not anything. Mm. And I think for me, with the Gullah Stick Pounding, you know, the drums were taken away there, but all the houses were built on stilts because it floods. So they would use sticks and mortars and pestles in their feet and turn the whole place into a drum. And it's a particular rhythm that is used when the Gullah rhythm. And my feeling about this and why I want people to learn this is because, to me, contained within that rhythm is that longing and desire for freedom and connection.
When the sun.
And that how do you hold on to yourself in a situation that doesn't even think you have a self?
I can hear the sun.
And so I do these big stick pounding workshops with people to talk about community and how when we are connected within a group, that we are responsible to hold each other's stories for those times when we forget.
And I pray for peace.
That was vocal activist Melanie DeMore speaking with KALW's Jen Sheehan. You can catch her performing at a benefit and celebration for Buddhist teacher Shahara Godfrey. That's July 16th at the East Bay Meditation Center. All the details are at KALW.org. Click Crosscurrents. And as always, please, please send us local artist suggestions. Who do you listen to and where do you go around the Bay for a great musical experience? Email us at news@kalw.org. You have been sending some good ones, so keep them coming. And subscribe to our podcast. You can find it in the iTunes store or at our website, kalw.org/subscribe. Our team includes Bonnie Chan, Jürgen Klemm, Lila Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Lucy Kang, Justine Lee, Ted Muldoon, Raja Shah, Stephen Short, and Judy Silber. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.